The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act was passed by Congress in 1990, the result of two decades of work that started in Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In 1971, an Iowa highway crew uncovered the bones of 28 people. 26 were Caucasian. They were moved and reburied. Two were Native American. Their remains were sent to the Office of the State Archaeologist. This was the act that galvanized Iowa activist Maria Pearson. This hour, we'll talk about her life and her legacy. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Maria Pearson was born in Springfield, South Dakota in 1932. She was a member of the Turtle Clan of the Yankton Sioux tribe. In spite of having little formal education, she became an influential actor in policymaking and even in the modern practices of archaeology and anthropology. She's known as the founding mother of the modern Indian repatriation movement. And today we'll explore her life and her legacy. My first guest today is Larry Zimmerman. He's an archaeologist and professor of anthropology and museum studies at the University of Indiana, Purdue. Hello, Larry.
Hi, how are you today?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And I'd like you to help us understand the moment when Maria Pearson really became galvanized by what she saw as maltreatment of Native Americans in this country. And I want to go back to a moment in 1971 when a highway crew in Iowa uncovered the bones of 28 people. Can you describe what happened?
Sure. There was an excavation going on with the relocation of Highway 34 coming off of Interstate 29 just west of Glenwood. There had been a cemetery there that was part of the town of Pacific Junction, Iowa, back in the late 1800s. And there were quite a number of non-Indian pioneer period graves there that had been disturbed or were going to be disturbed by the highway. They were scheduled to be taken out by the morticians from Glenwood, Iowa. And as the excavations were going on of the site and those remains, they uncovered some Native American remains on the edge of the site. And the Native American remains were pulled out of the ground and taken back to the archaeology laboratory in Iowa City by the state archaeologist then, Marshall McCusick. John Pearson, who was Maria's husband, was part of the Iowa DOT and found out about that. And one of the things that he said, I guess when he got home that day, was, honey, you're going to be pretty mad, and told her about that particular excavation of the Indian remains being taken back to Iowa City and the non-Indian remains being reburied right away in Glenwood. And Maria got very angry about unequal treatment of the remains, and that set her into action. And then she set up a time, I guess, to go into then-Governor Ray's office and try to meet with him.
Well, and a lot of us get angry about various things, but clearly this was a moment when she decided that she had to act.
That's correct.
And had she been politically involved before that?
Not so much. She'd been involved with her family. She talked often about her grandmother saying to her, someday you're going to have to stand up for your people. And this is the time I think she told me once that she decided she had to do that. She certainly had been involved with some of the American Indian activism that was going on in the late 1960s, and some of that was aimed toward archaeological sites and archaeological excavations, but not so much at that moment in terms of the treatment of human remains, but mostly archaeology in general, and that was certainly part of it.
When she decided that she wanted to do something, did she go straight to the governor? Is that, was that her route?
That's what I understand. That's the story she told pretty often. She put on her regalia, her traditional Native clothing, and went into the state capitol building and I guess met with the secretary of the governor and said, I'd like to see Governor Ray and talk to him about getting my people back. And I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but I understand that the secretary told him her that she wasn't the governor wasn't there. And at that moment, she saw the governor peeking out from behind some sort of panel down the hallway a little bit, and then at that point said, well, I see him right there, so I'd like to talk to him. And I guess he called her in, and they started chatting about it. And she once said, the governor asked her, well, what do you mean? Can I get my people back? And that, I guess, was the start of a long conversation between them.
Well, certainly. And I want to bring Dwayne Anderson into the conversation now. Dwayne Anderson is a former Iowa State archaeologist, and Dwayne is on the line with us today from his home in Arizona. Hello, Dwayne.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here.
And you were not the state archaeologist in 1971 when these bodies were exhumed and the Native American remains were sent to the Office of the State Archaeologist. You took over shortly after that. Can you describe for me the controversy in the archaeological community about what should be done with Native American remains?
Well, it was pretty much generally felt at the time by most of the archaeologists that the graves were open for scientific investigation, that they had a right to do this, and that the Indians shouldn't bother them. They didn't feel that there was any real close connection between modern Indians and the ancient people, and pretty much opposed any efforts on the Indians' part to get involved.
So in your office, what was the conversation like about this? Was everybody basically in agreement that archaeologists should have access to these remains and it was nobody else's business?
Well, it's not quite that easy. As Larry described, the Glenwood Project was in 1971. I started as a state archaeologist in 1975, so there'd been a couple more incidents, actually several more in the meantime, that made it pretty clear that there needed to be some kind of a resolution. And all of the archaeologists got together in a conference called The Future of Iowa Archaeology that was held in Decorah early in 1975, and decided that something needed to be done, and sort of appointed me, since I was just becoming the state archaeologist, to try to make some connections and to try to work out some kind of accommodation or understanding before any more incidents came along to make things worse. But before that could really get started, there was an accidental discovery of a site near Council Bluffs called the Lewis Central School site. It was on U.S. Highway 275, but it wasn't a highway project. It was on the Lewis Central School site property where an excavation was being done, actually using some of the Les Hills deposit as a borrow pit for a building that was being constructed at the school. So here in the middle of the uncertainty, when we didn't even think that any laws covered the ancient human remains, we had a discovery that resulted in 24-hour police protection for the site. We had a lot of the looters or pot hunters sort of standing by ready to come in and take anything they could get if they had a break. And we had a number of different Indian tribes represented standing around with their arms folded demanding that something be done to protect these remains. So when I arrived on the scene, it was already a mess, and it was already in the papers, and everybody was all upset about it. And so that's where Maria's leadership really came in, because she was able to work with the other Indians, and they sort of informally put her in charge of trying to work with the solution, whatever that might be. The original plan was to have the county coroner get an undertaker and go to the site and recover the remains and rebury them in a township cemetery. That, of course, would completely preclude even identifying if they were Indian, completely preclude studying the bones, and leave the archaeologists and any possible information that might come about the past by the wayside. And so when we arrived, Maria walked up to this guy from the funeral home named Cutler, and she said, "Okay, Cutler, how would you do this?" And he said, "I'd get a backhoe and a bulldozer, and we'd have these remains out of the ground in no time and get them off to the cemetery." And she asked me what I would do, and I said, well, I told her about dental picks and toothbrushes and whisk brooms and how we would carefully work around the bones and measure and photograph and so forth, so we could document what was actually there, because some of the site had already been disturbed and the bones were in pretty bad shape. She turned to me and she said, "You're going to do it." And so that was kind of the beginning. We recovered the remains. There were 25 individuals identified in the long run from what we called an ossuary. It was 2,500 years before the present. In other words, around 860 B.C., so it was an early dated site of the late Archaic period, one that was a site for a period that was very poorly known. And so there was some real archaeological value that came out of this. But at the same time, there was no funding for it, so we had to go to the governor jointly, Maria and I, to get funding to do the excavations. And then we had to try to determine what kind of study would be done. And Maria realized that until we proved that they were Indians, they didn't even want them. They didn't want to be involved. And so that was all done. The role of the state archaeologist was clarified in the law that was passed just a few months later with approval of the state historic preservation officer, the unanimous consent of the Association of Bioarchaeologists, which was an informal nonprofit group, the state archaeologist's office, I think I mentioned historic preservation. And so we were in a position then to really resolve any future problems. The law provided for a cemetery to be created for the reburial of remains, so we eventually relocated the remains from the Lewis Central School site to the first cemetery.
And the law you're referring to is the Iowa Reburial Law that was passed in 1976, right?
Right. And that's part of Section 305A, which is the section of the code that established the State Archaeologist's Office back in 1959.
And we need to take a short break. We'll get back to that law and how Maria Pearson influenced it, how her influence spread around the nation as well. Today we're talking about the life and legacy of Iowa activist Maria Pearson. And with me is Dwayne Anderson. He was the state archaeologist of Iowa. We're talking to him from his home in Arizona today. Also with us is Larry Zimmerman. He's an archaeologist and professor of anthropology and museum studies at the University of Indiana, Purdue. He was a good friend of Maria Pearson's, and we'd love to hear from you this hour as well. Join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're talking about the life and legacy of Iowa activist Maria Pearson. She's known as the founding mother of the modern Indian repatriation movement. It was because of her influence that the Iowa burial laws were made in 1976. We were just talking about those a moment ago. We'll get into that in a few minutes as well. And then later on, in 1990, a federal law was put into place because of the work that she was done, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. With me today, Larry Zimmerman, an archaeologist and professor of anthropology and museum studies at the University of Indiana, Purdue, also a good friend of Maria Pearson's, and Dwayne Anderson, who was the state archaeologist back when the Iowa reburial laws were passed. And Dwayne, just before the break, we were talking about when those laws were passed in Iowa. And you became a supporter of the Iowa reburial laws. You also became instrumental in helping to shape those laws. When you decided that you wanted to be a part of that movement, how did people within the archaeological community and within your office react?
Well, our office was very small, and they were very, very supportive of the people who were there at the time. And Yet on the national level and even the regional level, if we went to conferences, we would be scolded because we were reburying our database, we were reburying artifacts, we were making archaeology difficult. So it wasn't very popular. Actually, the nearer an archaeologist lived to living Indians in reservations and so forth, the more attuned they were to Indian concerns. The more you were in a big city or something like that, why the less you felt the Indians had any say at all.
And can you describe for me what the law said when it was passed in 1976?
Well, basically it clarified the role of the state archaeologist in conducting investigations. It established state cemetery burial, and I think there are at least a half a dozen cemeteries for that purpose. It clarified the code that 714.21 that dealt with a violation of sepulcher, and it created a penalty for disturbing graves, and this is even on private land, 2 years or $2,500 or both was the penalty. And it basically prevented anyone from digging anyone else up without a court order or some legal reason, such as was given to the state archaeologist. So it was a pretty encompassing law.
And Larry, can you also shed some light for us on that time period and on the controversy in the archaeological community?
Yeah, it was a pretty rough time period for a lot of people, both Native and archaeologists who happened to support repatriation. I know that as Duane probably found out, a lot of us were sort of almost shunned by our colleagues in many cases. And even though we attended meetings and tried to talk with our colleagues about it, a lot of people just really wouldn't listen a whole lot. But as time wore on, people began to understand things. And Duane may have more knowledge about this than I, but the Iowa law really influenced archaeologists in quite a number of other states.
And the Iowa law was the first of its kind in the nation.
As far as I'm aware, yeah. But by the time the 1990 federal law was passed, I think more than 30 states had some level or another of treatment of human remains laws that covered Native American remains. And I think what was happening was that there was a sort of growing understanding on the part of quite a few archaeologists, their students, and others that it was the right thing to do. But still, there were a lot of people holding archaeology. There were some pretty acrimonious meetings at the Society for American Archaeology and other places. There was one organization that really began to become more active in trying to work with Native Americans, and that was the World Archaeological Congress, which we should probably talk about later.
When was it decided, and Duane, maybe you'll be able to shed light on this, when was it decided that the remains of white settlers were not the purview of archaeologists, but that those would be reburied?
Well, the original law of violation of sepulcher was interpreted by the Attorney General at the time the Lewis Central School site came up as not pertaining to ancient graves at all. So that was the protection for settlers' graves. But on the other hand, when the law was passed, it gave us a floating time period of 150 years. So the state archaeologist has jurisdiction over anything 150 years old or older. And more modern period is the purview of the county coroner, basically.
Okay. So when we got that incident in 1971, though, with the 28 graves in the same place, wouldn't they have all been buried at the same time?
Yeah. I mean, you would think that would have been that way, but they didn't, figure on encountering the so-called Indian princess. That was the thing that really changed the perception, I think, as Larry said earlier, about how to treat people. But right now, I guess they are treated differently in the sense that 150 years is a floating time period. And so the state archaeologist now, what is it, some 36 years after the law was passed, has another 36 years in their jurisdiction, if you see what I mean.
Okay. And Duane, we talked about when you first encountered Maria Pearson in 1975. Larry, when did you first meet her?
It probably would have been about that same time. I remember a meeting, maybe Duane can clarify this for us both, but it was in Ames at Iowa State, and there was some discussion there that I guess Professor Gradwall sort of arranged of Iowa archaeologists, and Maria was there and talked with us about her concerns. And I know that at that particular time, she and I didn't particularly hit it off because of a project I'd worked on in South Dakota that she sort of misunderstood, which that became clarified later for us both as we talked individually. I don't know. Duane, do you remember that meeting in Iowa State?
Yeah, I do. And that was really my first experience to see Maria in action. Maria, we ought to talk a little about her because she's a very complex and interesting character. Most everyone has a boss. You and I, Larry, we all have bosses, but that wasn't true of Maria. She didn't have a boss. She didn't mind taking on anyone at any level. One time she was at my house in Iowa City shortly after this law thing was going on, and she was concerned about what was going on at the federal level, and I said, well, that's something we can't control. And she says, can I use your phone? And I said, yes, and I heard her in the next room saying, I'd like to speak to President Ford. I don't think she got through to him, but I mean, she had my attention.
So what was your first impression of her, Duane?
Well, I was a little bit apprehensive because, you know, she had this reputation for ruling with an iron hand. But I found her to be very open-minded and reasonable. You know, once, like Jill Airy said, once you have a chance to talk about it, it wasn't that she was so closed-minded that she – some of the activists were. They had one mission, and they were going to do it, and they didn't want to hear anything else. And that was true of the Indians as well as the archaeologists. But Maria really took charge, helped to coordinate the Indian committee that was self-appointed by the Native American community. They still have the Indian committee to advise the state archaeologist's office. When Maria heard about a discovery, I would either pick her up or we would meet in the field. She went to countless projects where human remains were found. As Larry mentioned, she'd go to national meetings and regional meetings, and she'd usually tell me before we went in, now I'm going to have to say some things, and you're not going to like it. And so then she'd go and she'd chew me out along with everybody else, and then afterwards she'd come and say, well, that wasn't too bad, was it?
So Larry, did you find her to be a little frightening when you first met her?
At the beginning, but once you sort of got to be her friend and figured her out, she was just kind of delightful to be around, and you just enjoyed watching her push buttons, sort of like Duane was hinting. And I think I remember, Duane, a story that she told about you. I think one of the first times that she met you, maybe the governor had told you to go out and talk to her. And she tells me, and I don't know if it's your recollection or not, but she said that this young man appeared at her door in Marnie. Was that where she lived?
Yeah.
And invited you in. And offered you coffee, and you said, no, thank you. And she said, get out of here. You just insulted me by turning down a gift or something of that nature. And suggested that for a few moments you were terrified until she started laughing.
Yeah, she just wanted to give me a hard time.
Yeah, she was really good at that. And she would do it not just us. She would do it to Native Americans as well when they sort of spoke out in ways that she didn't think were appropriate. I remember at a conference that she was invited to speak at the University of South Dakota where I was teaching, and there was a young student of mine who was Native, a guy named Bronco LeBeau, and he was kind of running the session that he had organized there about repatriation. And he said some things at the beginning that she didn't think were very good, and she said during our break, get that guy and come out in the hallway, and we're going to talk. And she chewed him up one side and down the other about forgetting to introduce the elders and not offering a prayer and a number of other things. And he was just standing there sort of burbling like a young man who'd just been chewed out by an elder. And He later went on to get a PhD in archaeology, believe it or not, and is now with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he often, I think, was sort of galvanized by his experiences working with Maria. This happened a lot to many of us, including some of the big-name archaeologists. There was an archaeologist whose name was Clem Meehan, I think from UCLA. They were often at each other's throat, and I remember them giving opposite kinds of statements at meetings. And then I remember her right afterwards just going up to Clem and chatting and everything else, and they didn't seem to be particular enemies. I remember then when Clem passed away, she told me, she said, you know, Clem and I were often at odds, but I'm really worried about him now because he's passed on to the spirit world. He's not going to be treated too well there.
All right. Well, Maria was funny and soft-hearted, but a lot of times you didn't see that side, you know, because she was usually ready for action. I know that Governor Ray played a really important role because he was very understanding of the situation overall and very willing to work with Maria. And Maria would always try to, she called him the Great White Father, and liked trying to push him around or give him the feeling that she was pushing him around. I know at one point I remember she went in and he was reluctant to see her, and she just went in and sat on the edge of his desk. He had to deal with her at that point.
We're talking today about activist Maria Pearson and her influence, her life, her legacy. My guests right now are Larry Zimmerman. He's an archaeologist and professor of anthropology and museum studies at the University of Indiana, Purdue. Dwayne Anderson, a former state archaeologist in Iowa, is speaking with us from his home now in Arizona. And if you knew Maria Pearson, she passed away in 2003, but many people in Iowa knew her and were touched by her. If you knew her, we'd love to hear your story as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Larry, once the law was passed in Iowa in 1976, the Iowa reburial laws, and we've talked about how these were the first laws of that nature in the nation, how did Maria move from the Iowa stage to the national stage?
I think it was mostly through her influence, although people knew about the Iowa law and knew about her abilities to speak very strongly about the treatment of remains. And she was invited to a number of meetings, especially with executive members and others from the Society for American Archaeology, which is the largest body of professional archaeologists in the U.S., and was invited to speak at a number of sessions that they held that were sort of plenary sessions where most of the membership came to hear about it. She was always pretty eloquent when she got up to speak, and she wasn't afraid to say what she thought. I think at some point in time terrified a lot of those people, but once they listened to her, they understood that there was something more going on here than just the politics of identity or whatever that many people suggested that it all was. At that point, she also had influence on a lot of younger Native Americans. I know, for example, that there was a woman, Jan Hamill, who I worked with later on, who was the director of American Indians Against Desecration, which was kind of a spinoff of the American Indian Movement. And I know that Jan and Maria talked on occasion, and Jan then became a spokesperson as well at the national level and international level. And I think that it was Maria's influence as much as anything else on other people that really caused the repatriation movement to gain speed.
It wasn't a speedy process, though.
Oh, no.
As I mentioned, this federal legislation, the Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act, was passed in 1990.
I think it's all relative in the sense of time. Of course, when you get older, time seems to compress itself a bit, and it seems a lot faster. But one of the things that did occur was that she got hooked up as well with the World Archaeological Congress, which was a kind of spin-off of another group that first met in England in 1986. And she didn't go to that meeting, but she later on attended a meeting 4 years later in South America that became a very important meeting for the World Archaeological Congress in terms of passing an ethics code. But the year before that, she actually attended a meeting which was kind of a subset of the World Archaeological Congress out in South Dakota. And that meeting had a couple of hundred people from all over the world, a lot of other indigenous people who, I think many of them actually came there to meet Maria as much as anything else because she was on the panel with some people from the State Archaeologist's Office in Iowa to talk about the Iowa law. And it was not too long after that that really the first federal law came about, and that was the National Museum of the American Indian Act in 1989, the year that this inter-Congress of the World Archaeological Congress was held. And I think that a lot of the things that were going on were at least partly the result of Maria's activism within the Society for American Archaeology and the World Archaeological Congress. But just a sort of gradual, I guess, as you would want to call it, a growth of the number of individuals who were really committed to the idea of repatriation. I think we also consider, and maybe we can talk about it later as well, but what was obvious to a lot of us who were teaching anthropology and archaeology was that a lot of our students picked up really quickly on this idea of repatriation and how important it was to Native people. And they started getting the idea, and I think also then had a lot of influence on their professors and fellow students and others.
I need to take a quick break here. My guests are Larry Zimmerman, an archaeologist and professor of anthropology and museum studies at the University of Indiana, Purdue, and Dwayne Anderson, a former state archaeologist of Iowa. And we'll continue our conversation taking a look at the life and legacy of Maria Pearson in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the life and legacy of Iowa Native American activist Maria Pearson. She was influential in getting really a groundbreaking law passed in 1976, the Iowa Reburial Laws, and her work continued, and she was very influential in getting the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act passed in 1990, a federal act to protect the remains of Native Americans all over the country. With me today, Larry Zimmerman. He's an archaeologist and professor of anthropology and museum studies at the University of Indiana, Purdue. Also, Dwayne Anderson, a former state archaeologist of Iowa. And joining us now is Joe Watkins. He is director of the Native American Studies Program at the University of Oklahoma. Hello, Joe.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm basking in such reflected glory of other two speakers.
You also knew Maria Pearson. Can you tell me about when you met her?
I met her kind of indirectly, both as a young student and as a struggling fedskin, if you will, an archaeologist with the Department of the Interior. I was kind of involved with some of the consultations out of the American Indian Religious Freedom Act hearings and got to talk with her a bit. And, you know, as both of the other two speakers have said, she was often scolding but always respectful. We had a few conversations about, well, how the Department of the Interior policies on reburial of human remains was very much Eurocentric and really didn't take into consideration American Indian perspectives.
In your career, how have you seen that shift, Joe?
Well, I myself am American Indian. I'm a member of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, so it had always been definitely in the middle for me trying to figure out how to do archaeology and yet how to deal with the double standards. I started doing archaeology in 1968. Went to the University of Oklahoma right at the time that Vine Deloria Jr. was chastising anthropologists and archaeologists. So I've seen it shift from a time of anthropologists and archaeologists being very hesitant to work with tribal groups up until now, when many American Indian tribes employ archaeologists, have taken over the management of archaeological resources on their own land. So there's, I wouldn't say there's been a total shift, but there's been a continual movement toward a middle ground, if you will.
Let's let Larry weigh in on that as well. I mean, obviously the laws have changed about how Native American remains are treated in this country. Have you witnessed an attitude shift, Larry, within the archaeological community?
Oh yeah, I think definitely, although there still is a fair ways to go, as Joe hinted. I think I'm sort of using the word hinted nicely in some ways. There are still quite a few people who are adamantly against repatriation or dealing with remains. But as time moved on, a whole number of archaeologists began to work more directly with tribal people, both here and internationally. It became a very much an international kind of movement as well. The students, I think, who were coming up began to see that shift, and quite a number of Native American students began to take a look at archaeology again. And Joe is kind of a leader in that. He published a really important book, I think it was based on his doctoral dissertation, that was called Indigenous Archaeology. And that began a kind of transition toward doing what a lot of us now call Indigenous Archaeology, which is a direct engagement of archaeologists, whether they're Native or non-Native, working directly with Native people or other Indigenous people as collaborators, not as anything but that. They're partners in the research, helping set research agendas, looking at all kinds of information that are available to understand the past, and really trying to understand as well not how just archaeology can understand the past, but also how Native peoples understand the past and use the past. It really expanded the kinds of awareness that a lot of archaeologists had about how really complicated the past was. As we tend to say, many threaded and many vocal, many different ways of seeing things in the past. And after that, I think that the number of students getting advanced degrees in archaeology has really increased, and it seems to be accelerating, as Joe can probably say more than I.
Well, and, you know, earlier in the conversation, I mentioned that Maria Pearson didn't have a lot of formal education, although as a Native American woman born in the early 1930s, the cards were kind of stacked against her in the education department anyway. But I have marveled a little bit at how being a mother of six and being a woman who didn't have a lot of formal education, how she became so influential in this world. And Joe, maybe you can give us a little bit of insight. Clearly, you're a man who you have the Native American heritage, you have the education. But at the time when Maria Pearson was really coming onto the scene, were there many people who had both?
There were not. At the time, I knew of two other American Indians with an MA in archaeology. There were anthropologists, American Indian anthropologists with PhDs, but many were hesitant to go into archaeology. I became aware of her work initially reading Akwesasne Notes, you know, some of the American Indian newspapers of the early 1970s, and it discussed her involvement with the Iowa burial law and with the movement to try to get equal treatment of human remains. I think that many of the American Indians involved in archaeology at the time were really hesitant to step outside of the accepted means of dealing with the past, if you will, because oftentimes they were made to feel either ridiculed or they were told that they couldn't be an archaeologist if they couldn't be objective. Mm. And the idea was that American Indians had to accept science and reject their tradition, or reject science and accept tradition. It was very difficult to choose or to actually to negotiate a middle ground at that time.
Did you find yourself facing that same challenge?
Oh, certainly, certainly. And I remember that I went to school here at the University of Oklahoma, which has a very large Indian population in the state. But the archaeologists that I worked under kind of laughed whenever I would post a cartoon about American Indians planning on going to Arlington Cemetery and excavating there, and then they would laugh a little bit and then say, well, if those Indians only knew what we did, they would embrace us. And I kept saying, well, if you only understood what the Indians are going through, you would embrace them as well. Mm-hmm. But it was a time of, as some Indians in the East say, it was a time of hiding in plain sight, being an archaeologist and being kind of damned by the archaeologists and being damned by the American Indians and not knowing how to try to help both communities come together. It was a difficult time.
We're talking today about the life and legacy of Iowa Native American activist Maria Pearson. And earlier, I invited people who knew her, knew of her work, to give us a call at 866-780-9100. We did hear from someone who knows her extremely well. Her son, Ron, called. He doesn't want to be on the air, but he wanted to say that he is thankful for the work that all of you did with his mother. And we also now have Pat on the line from Nevada. Hi, Pat.
Good morning, Charity.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, in the vein of recognizing these key individuals in Maria's past, Larry, Duane, and Joe, but there was some ongoing work that she engaged with the Peregrine Falcons here in Iowa when we were hoping to establish some collaboration with Native people in Northeast Iowa. Maria Pearson handled those introductions, if you will, with the Ho-Chunk Nation. And so she, her work spread beyond the sacred repatriation work, but she was very current and very very connected to wildlife and wildlife issues here in Iowa.
Oh, well, Pat, thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for the program.
Thanks a lot for your call. And you can join us at 866-780-9100. Before the show today, we were talking about how Maria Pearson is so well known inside archaeological and anthropological communities and not very well known outside those communities. She did a great deal of work with education in Iowa, helping Iowa history teachers correct their textbooks and tell the truth, or at least some of the truth, about Native American events and culture. And she did a great deal of other work as well. Duane, what do you think that the general public should know about Maria Pearson?
Well, one thing we haven't talked very much about, because we've kind of been in the political and legal realm, is that she was a very spiritual person. I mentioned being soft-hearted and funny, but on the spiritual side, a lot of times if something came up, why, she would say, well, it's not a good day. We better not do something today. We better do it tomorrow. I remember one time we were driving. I picked her up in Marnie. We were clear up in the area around Forest City, headed toward the Dubuque. And we turned on the radio, and we heard, because the sky was dark, we heard about tornadoes in the area, and she said, we better turn back. And I said, well, you know, we can't. We got a meeting to go to, or a reburial. I forget what it was. But she says, no, we need to turn back. And so I decided we'd keep going. And so we watched the tornado as it came along, and it bounced along not too far back from the road, tearing up buildings and making a mess of things in general. And we drove out the other side, and she said, well, I think it was meant to be. She said, the Great Spirit approved of us today and what we're doing. And so it's just one of those things where she was, again, I begin this conversation earlier in the broadcast by saying she didn't have a boss, but I sort of take that back, because the Great Spirit really was the boss, and she did pay attention.
It's interesting, Duane, with what Joe was talking about, how so many Native Americans in archaeology being pressured to choose one side or the other. Do you think that her spiritual side, do you think that that hurt her credibility in archaeological communities?
No, she never compromised her core beliefs. But she was willing to be practical. She knew that erosion would destroy sites. She knew that construction projects and highway alignments couldn't really be changed, that things had to be done. So she had this practical side that allowed her to sort of mitigate her core beliefs, but never abandon them.
Larry, what do you want the general public to know about Maria Pearson?
Golly, whenever I think of Maria, I always think of her just delightful sense of humor once she got to know you a little bit. She would do things and say things. She would often go visit people at Springfield on the Yankton Sioux Reservation, and she respected her Yankton Sioux roots, and she would drive through Vermilion, South Dakota, where I taught at the time, and she would always delight in saying, "We're going to have dinner today at the Cowboy Restaurant." That was one of the few restaurants in the city right along the highway heading toward Springfield. And she would get in there and start telling story after story after story. And sometimes she could have a little body sense of humor, too, and could tell the occasional story that was a little bit over the edge. But she was just always so much fun to be around. And you could poke fun at her, and she would take it well. And she was always... Really, also very respectful of everybody, I think, even those she disagreed with. And I think that was one of the things that allowed her to be so effective in what she did.
Joe, I'll give you the chance to weigh in on that question as well. What should people know?
Well, I think Larry hit on it right at the very end. She was very respectful, and I held her up as an example that you can actually disagree with someone, you can have a toe-to-toe argument, you can yell and scream, and then still have a conversation with that individual. You may disagree with an individual's position, but that doesn't mean you don't like the individual. And so in that regard, I think she was a perfect example of the difficulties of trying to negotiate with such very important issues, such as repatriation, reburial, that you can disagree with a person's position on the situation, but you don't dislike the person for having that opinion. And so I think she was very much a person who was able to look at alternative perspectives, to weigh those perspectives, and occasionally she agreed and might change her position a bit, but generally she held to her beliefs, and she supported those, and she supported others having their own beliefs as well.
In your work with both archaeology and Native American studies, Joe, what, if she were alive today, what do you think, what issues would she be working on now?
I think she would continue to be working on how archaeologists represent American Indians in the past. Some of the concepts of archaeological cultures have divorced, at least from the archaeological perspective, American Indians from much of their heritage. I think she would continue to work on trying to find ways to look at the very early people who came to the New World and try to help both archaeologists and American Indians understand that those individuals contributed to the development of 568 different tribes that we know of, and that not one single person can own the past, but that every individual has a responsibility to keep that past a part of contemporary culture.
Joe, thank you so much.
More than welcome. Thank you.
Joe Watkins is director of the Native American Studies Program at the University of Oklahoma. Larry Zimmerman, thank you for being here today.
You're very welcome.
Larry Zimmerman is an archaeologist and professor of anthropology and museum studies at the University of Indiana, Purdue. And Dwayne Anderson, thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Dwayne Anderson, a former state archaeologist from the state of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us an email anytime. We'd love to hear your thoughts about things you've heard on the show. We'd love to hear your suggestions about things you'd like to hear on the show. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we'll take a look at Thanksgiving traditions. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.